Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this week's The Space Show, we resume our Planet Earth series with ANU Vice Chancellor Brian Schmidt and former Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield.
Earth below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
Welcome to episode 8 of our Planet Earth series. Now, these programs are a mix of factual reports, poetry, and fanciful music, and all of them about our home planet. And yes, this is the 8th in the series. We broadcast the first 7 last year, and you can find them on our programs for 2020 on our Space Show website, which is at space.southernfm.com.au. So that's space.southernfm.com.au to find the previous ones. But don't do it just yet, because we've got Program 8 coming up right now. And we begin with Brian Schmidt. Now, in 2011, he was one of 3 scientists awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics. Since 2015, he has been Vice Chancellor at the Australian National University in Canberra. In January this year, he gave this speech on climate science.
It's a great honour to be asked to speak on behalf of the people of Australia and the global scientific community at this important summit. As per our traditions here in Australia, I celebrate and pay my respects to the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people of the Canberra region, whose cultures are among the oldest continuing cultures in human history, going back a mere 20,000 years or so here in Canberra. I know that to many, the task we are discussing here today, heading off cataclysmic climate change, appears so huge and so difficult that it sometimes seems futile. Such people say that our world is so vast and so timeless that any claim that we can influence it for good or ill is conceited, an act of hubris. It's this attitude we must combat. Because by employing science with the necessary scale, urgency, and collaboration, we can and will succeed. But we need to keep learning, and we need to keep doing. The starting point is adopting a different perspective, the perspective of science. As it's my area of expertise, let me give you the perspective of astronomy. Why astronomy? Because when you grasp the true scale of the ever-expanding universe, you realize just how wrong the doubters are when they say the world is too big and too timeless for us to alter its behavior. I want you to recall a famous image of our Earth, the tiny, pale blue dot taken by the Voyager spacecraft as it sped out of our solar system in 1990. Turning the Voyager camera back towards Earth was a masterstroke, because that image showed, like nothing else, that our world is smaller and more fragile than we think. And it has never looked more fragile than right now. The comfortable, prosperous life we live in the narrow gap between the bottom of the oceans and the top of the atmosphere has never been more at risk. And the danger to Earth is real, and the need to address it is urgent. We are, of course, becoming more and more accustomed to big and urgent problems. Our worries this year have been about a disease. But the people of the world may recall that this time last year, the east coast of Australia was on fire, our air barely breathable, and our people having to be evacuated from the flames by the Royal Australian Navy. What happened in my country last year is what the whole world may one day have to face. In just the last 12 months, my own university has had to cope with extreme bushfire and hail events, in addition to the pandemic. And as someone once said, nothing focuses the mind like the prospect of facing a firing squad. We are focused on climate change like never before. And as a member of the world scientific community, I'm here to tell you that science, as always, stands ready to serve the people of the world. Renewing our trust in science and other forms of knowledge is vital. In recent times, that trust has been undermined. Science, expertise, evidence, the purveyors of doubt have tried to devalue these powerful weapons in the fight against climate change, and we cannot let them succeed. Things, though, are starting to swing back. Medical science has brilliantly come to the rescue in the gravest crisis the people of the world have faced for generations. By tackling COVID-19, science undertaken with urgency, scale, and international cooperation has proven its value to humanity. The goodwill that science has generated must now be harnessed to this next big battle. So what must we do? Put simply, we need to keep learning and we need to keep doing. We need to trust in science and engage all of our resources, including our universities. On becoming a Nobel laureate, my father said to me, "You've got a Nobel Prize. You can do anything you want. So why on earth would you take on one of the hardest jobs in the world and run a university?" And my answer was that universities and other places of knowledge and science have a crucial role to play in solving humanity's biggest problems. Tackling climate change is the clearest and most urgent example. The things universities teach and research, like science, engineering, economics, public policy, and other things, are providing the answers. But we just need to implement them faster and greater scale and with genuine global cooperation. With the world on trajectory to exceed a 1.5 degrees Celsius increase above pre-industrial levels between 2027 and 2042, there must be no delay, no half measures, no jurisdictions working against each other. For Australia, which is such a large per capita contributor to global emissions and which has such abundance of natural renewable resources, one answer lies in scaling up clean energy generation as soon as possible. This is an urgent moral obligation which Australia must not shirk. And my own university is playing its part. The Australian National University has adopted what we call the ANU Below Zero Initiative, a plan to make the university carbon net negative by reducing our own emissions and by using our research assets to help the world pull carbon down from the atmosphere. Earlier this week, I spoke to 500 future leaders in science finishing their last year of high school about the challenges of addressing climate change at the National Youth Science Forum here in Australia. I challenged them to come up with the best idea for using COVID-19 stimulus spending to boost climate adaptation. And I intend to share the top five ideas with our Prime Minister because he needs to hear from the people who are going to inherit our planet. I'll share one idea with you now. Each year, the methane burps of beef and buffalo produce 2 gigatons equivalent of carbon dioxide. Young science students Phoebe and Wen have suggested a great investment is to use an Australian discovery that by adding a small amount of a specific type of seaweed to the feed of bovine reduces their methane emissions by about 90%, with a corresponding increase in livestock productivity. Investing in the future research and capital for farming the seaweed at a scale around the tropics, which also has the potential to improve water quality, provides an alternative, sustainable source of jobs and income for developing countries while increasing livestock production and dramatically cutting greenhouse gas emissions. This is a great idea and just one that our global leaders need to consider when they meet next week. This is learning and doing in action. This is the way forward. As an astronomer, I want to leave you with one additional thought. Our little world, our home, will survive global warming. Take it from me, the universe is littered with billions of uninhabitable planets. We humans may or may not survive. But unless we head off catastrophic global warming, our lives on this planet will be more difficult, more dangerous, and less pleasant. We have all seen the tragedies COVID-19 has caused and witnessed the pressures it has placed on our societies and our political systems. This will be nothing compared to the stress that is likely to follow uncontrolled global warming, with its floods, its fires, droughts, famines, and unbearable heat waves, just among the other human calamities not yet imagined. As in the pandemic, science employed with a necessary scale, urgency, and global collaboration is the answer. Keeping on learning and acting is the answer. The scientific world stands ready to act. Our universities stand ready to act. Let's get started.
Speaking in January of this year, that was Brian Schmidt, the Vice Chancellor of the Australian National University in Canberra. Well, this is The Space Show. This is our eighth program in our Planet Earth series. We have now an a cappella treatment of Michael Jackson's Earth Song, which was released in 1995. Now, this is not to be confused with the poem by Michael Jackson called Planet Earth. So here's Earth Song by Sam Robson from 2016. Michael Jackson's Earth Song, sung there by Sam Robson on The Space Show.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
Earth, below us, drifting, falling, floating, weightless, calling, calling home.
And now, on our Planet Earth special, on The Space Show, we're going to hear from Chris Hadfield. He's a former Canadian astronaut, and earlier this year, or late last year, he had a conversation with Azusa Maruvama. Now, she's the director of talk at NHK. Here's how the conversation went.
Hi, I'm Chris Hadfield. I've spent a little time self-isolating on board a spaceship. How are you doing?
Mental health issues are becoming a bigger concern as the pandemic lockdown continues across the globe. We talked to an expert during these times of social distancing and asked him about his perspective on this unusual period. Chris Hadfield is a former astronaut and commander of the International Space Station. And a Canadian superstar.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I've left forevermore.
He was able to show us what's it like to live in space through social media. His video on self-isolation went viral when the world went into lockdown earlier this year. We asked him more about how he dealt with seclusion on the ISS and in how he is coping with sequestering during this pandemic.
All of us around the globe came to realize that this pandemic
is going to last for much longer than we expected. What should we do now?
The coronavirus has been a wicked thing for the world, and it's really messed up our normal way of life. Everything's been sort of disrupted in order to try and minimize the effects of this very serious pandemic. So how do you deal with it? How do you deal with it at the start? But maybe even more importantly, how do you deal with it now? And I think the primary thing is still just as important as it always has been, and that is to understand the actual danger.
In 2001, Hadfield had his first spacewalk and experienced an accident. A drop of fluid went into his eye, and it blocked his vision in zero gravity.
And there I was, holding on to the outside of a spaceship, and I was struck blind in both eyes. And I didn't know why, and I didn't know how long it was going to last. So what would you do? And there's lots of reasons to panic, I think, under those circumstances, or at least to be afraid. But I wasn't just anybody in those circumstances. I knew everything about my spacesuit. I knew how all of the systems worked. I knew how the air purification system worked. I understood the physiology of what was happening to my own body. Okay, so I can't see. I've lost one of my five senses for a bit. Okay. I can still breathe. I can still hear. Now I need to just deal with the actual reality of what's happening. I wasn't afraid at all. And after a while, my eyes teared enough and I flushed the oxygen out of the suit so that my vision cleared. I didn't let fear overcome me, but it was because I understood the danger. I had practiced for it. I had things that I could do. I had a purpose to what I was trying to accomplish. I think that applies to a lot of things in life. Don't let uneducated fear dictate your actions and your reactions and the shape of your own life.
The longest time you've spent in space was over 5 months. Chris, how did you approach that mentally?
Maybe the more important long-term thing, how do you now make this part of your life? you can't just be in love with your old life and go, oh, this has messed up my life. That's not the truth. This is your life. It's just existing under different circumstances. And so it's up to you completely to decide how you are going to adjust your pattern to fit into this new normal, this new reality. Imagine if you'd just been launched to a spaceship, and now you open up the hatch and you float into the space station. You are now as physically isolated and in as dangerous a place as any human being has ever been. And yet, it's totally up to you how you're going to live there. If you say, well, I still want to, I don't know, go to the McDonald's and go to the movie theater and see my grandma every week, then you're going to hate your existence. But if instead you recognize, okay, this is the new normal, and now I need to build a life for myself and my family and my work within this new normal, don't resent the reality of the world and the life around you. There are beautiful, undeniable things happening around you. And it's easy to get mired in the differences, but if you can really relish the beautiful things that are happening and make an effort to highlight them to yourself and celebrate them personally and with your family, then the new normal, I think, becomes a little easier to accept. And to me, that pattern, whether you're going to live on a spaceship or whether you're going to make it through a global pandemic, the rules are essentially the same.
I'm curious, did you ever get lonely being isolated in a confined space for so long?
I grew up on a farm out in the countryside. I had really no neighbors, you know, just our immediate family and work. And yet, later in life, I've lived in cities. I've never met a lonely farmer. The loneliest people I've ever met live in the middle of cities. So it's not physical isolation that leads to feelings of loneliness and being disconnected. I think it's a lack of self-worth. And to me, then, how do you address that? Well, give yourself purpose. If you're on board a spaceship, you can float to the window and see wonders, see the universe, see the world pouring by at 8 kilometers a second, watch a sunrise or a sunset every 46 minutes. Or you could lock yourself in your quarters and go, man, I'm inside an aluminum can and I'm separated from my family and there's nobody here to tell me that anything I'm doing is worthwhile. And both of those are totally personal choices. So I try and always focus on the purpose of what's happening, exult in the delight and the pleasures of what's around me. You have to somehow recognize that your prizes and rewards are internal. Let's say it's an expedition to the South Pole or the top of Mount Everest or to the top of Mount Fuji or to whatever, the bottom of the ocean. You're going to need equipment, but you're also going to need a little different attitude. And a large part of expeditionary behavior is putting the purpose and the goal ahead of yourself. And as an astronaut for the entire 21 years, because of the danger and the complexity, you have to put mission ahead of self. And that's what expeditionary behavior is about. And think about your actions. If you say, hey, I'm just going to, I don't know, take the snowmobile out for a joyride and go ripping around in the snowmobile. If you break the snowmobile, you have risked the lives of everybody else in the expedition because you were just pursuing something personal. So learning and cementing not only in your ideas, but in your own values and behaviors that mission and group success is more important than self. When I was a little kid, I think like a lot of little kids, I read comic books, you know, anime and then science fiction books. And all those things did was allow me to imagine things beyond my reality.
Hadfield's imagination was becoming a reality before his very own eyes just prior to turning 10.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It was as if you had been reading X-Men comics, and then you went back to your house and you looked out the window and X-Men went by. You're like, this is real? This is an actual thing? This is something that can happen? Well, shoot, I want to be part of that. It was the beautiful joining of fantasy and reality and permission to imagine myself doing those things, but then also a compulsion and an imperative to start changing who I was, to start giving myself new skills so that I could maybe be trusted to fly a spaceship someday.
Hadfield studied engineering and aviation and became the top test pilot among his peers. It took him 26 years to finally reach space.
In the back of my brain, I was actually a little bit worried. What if I get there after all of this work and I don't like it? But it was better than I dreamed it would be. The combination of weightlessness, which is just magic. You know, someone taps you on the top of the head and says, you can fly. You know, it's just joyous. And with the whole world pouring past, going around the world 16 times a day. So you get to see the world like nobody's ever seen it. It's so instructional and beautiful. And you're doing something really hard, but you're doing it well because of all that work you did, all that preparation that you did. That's a really intoxicating combination of competence, of beauty, and of magic all at the same time. It's definitely worth the work and worth the trip. If you get a chance to fly in space, go.
Today, Hadfield is working with the Open Lunar Foundation to build human settlement on the moon.
I think this is the moment in history where we start to settle the moon. I live in the Americas, in Canada, in North America. There were no human beings here up until about 18,000 years ago. But what made those shifts in human habitation and opportunity happen was technology. Someone invented a ship or the ability to control fire or the ability to store food or to make protective clothing. And suddenly we could get to a place that we'd never been before and make it part of human normal. And so the real question is, where is our technology good enough now that we can live someplace we've never lived before?
If we are going to live on the moon, what will our society look like?
This is a new opportunity to choose. How do we want the moon to be set up? It is important. So whose laws are we going to use on the moon? And if we don't think about it, then we could just have a little China on the moon, a little America on the moon, a little Russia on the moon, a little India on the moon. We could just import the historical strictures that confine us right now, sort of like a photocopy of us in time, and just wrap that on the moon. And we could do that. And that may be what happens. But I think it would be infinitely regrettable. A terrific example is the International Space Station. We've been living there for 20 years. Away from the Earth, with people from dozens of different countries. We haven't had a fight. We haven't had a war. We haven't needed a police force. We've been living with an entirely separate set of laws, the International Crew Code of Conduct on the space station, than any country on Earth, and it's worked. All of the discoveries about the universe and the discoveries about the world that have come from that, they come from a shift of self. Of perspective, of mental attitude, and of the behaviors that come from that. Prior to the pandemic, I marveled regularly at how thin the veneer of civilization is on top of the brutal nature of life itself. But whenever something globally disruptive happens, like a world war or a pandemic or a financial markets crash or something, that shouldn't be a surprise. That's normal. That happens. And it's always going to be messy. And it's never been perfect. This is just our reality. But I think it's up to each one of us to decide and find a way through it. The motto I live by is that the greatest antidote for fear is competence. If you're afraid of something, it's probably because you're not ready for it to happen. You can't be ready for everything, but you can be ready for most of the things in life that give you fear. Change who you are to be able to deal with the realities of life. It allows you to be relaxed and comfortable. I don't want to be all tensed up and scared all the time. I would much rather go on through life being ready for the things that are likely to happen. It allows you to notice the beauty and the nuance around you. The greatest antidote for fear is competence.
Courtesy of NHK, that was former Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield. We have more from Chris coming up shortly.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM,
where this is the Space Show. Now, Chris Hadfield did a number of things while he was on board the International Space Station, and one of them was to write songs. And he said, I sang a song for each of my children as a lullaby every night while they were small. But this one is from orbit for my wonderful daughter, Kristen, across the endlessness of space and time. Here is Chris Hadfield with Space Lullaby. The audio, the vocals recorded in space aboard the space station. The instrumentals are done here on Earth.
Darkness falls, a favorite blanket that surrounds us all. A quiet ending to a busy day of noise and troubles we have put away to sleep. You and I, you in your bedroom, me up in the sky, as close as dreaming we are holding hands. We hug so tightly as you lay now down. Unspoken magic may be what it seems. You soar so high with me, we touch the sky and lightly land upon the bed, lay down to sleep. You say I've been away too long. I'm only here and then I'm gone. But I am coming home to talk.
The Space Show, Chris Hadfield has an astronaut's guide to optimism.
We're all moving so fast. Just standing on the equator, with the world spinning underneath us, we're all going over 1,000 miles an hour. What if, just for a moment, we stopped? There are problems with everything, and nothing's yet perfect. But that shouldn't be cause to bemoan. That should be cause to achieve. Our world is a better place than we often claim it to be. We're living at an all-time high for health and wellness, and literacy has been sharply on the rise for decades. More people are living longer, and during childbirth, both infant and maternal mortality rates have plummeted in the last century, saving the lives of millions. We've seen a host of horrific diseases completely eradicated, and there are many more for which eradication is underway. We live the way we do because people chose to tackle their problems head on. In 100 years, we've gone from filming the Wright brothers to landing a camera on Titan, a moon 800 million miles away. There are a growing number of organizations and foundations leading the way to research, innovate, and affect change in the world. And partnering together, they're helping the world's poorest people lift themselves out of hunger and poverty. When thinking if you're going to be optimistic this year, remember, nobody changes the world on their own. It all starts with a resolution. What's yours?
Planet Earth is blue.
In the United States, NASA will design a new set of Earth-focused missions to provide key information to guide efforts related to climate change, disaster mitigation, fighting forest fires, and improving agriculture. The project is called Earth System Observatory. It will consist of satellites, each uniquely designed to complement the others. They will work together to create a three-dimensional view of Earth from bedrock to atmosphere. The new Earth System Observatory will build on work that NASA has done for over 3 decades. This announcement picks up on the recommendations made in 2017 by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine.
Welcome to NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California. I'm Marina Jurica. Joining me now is Karen St. Germain, who is the Earth Division Science Director at NASA headquarters. And she's going to give us a glimpse into the future of Earth missions for NASA. So this is an exciting time, and NASA has many NASA Earth Science missions that are orbiting and studying the Earth, from the carbon cycle to the atmosphere to sea level rise. And what is going to be in the future now as we head forward with NASA Earth Science missions that we can get excited about?
Absolutely. So we have a great year coming up. We've got 5 launches coming up in the coming year or so, and including SWOT and NISAR, which are both behind us here. Of course, Landsat 9, which is our partnership with USGS, as well as Maya and EMIT, 2 other aerosol and pollution observation systems. But after that, we are already starting to move out on the planning of what we're calling the Earth System Observatory. It'll be a collection of missions, instruments that view the entire Earth system from the atmosphere to the surface to the subsurface to give us a full 3D view of our planet.
So it's going to be a really busy next couple of years for us, which is so exciting, studying our planet Earth. Now, I've noticed with many of the Earth science missions, there's a lot of international collaboration. Why is that, and why is that important?
It's so important to us. The changes that we're seeing in our environment are global, and that means we need the global community of spacefaring nations to join with us to make all of the observations we need to make to really understand what's happening on our planet. And so these partnerships really just multiply what we're able to do.
Will we be sharing this information with people in other parts of the globe?
Absolutely. So NASA has long had a policy of full, free, and open data. But one of our major initiatives right now is something we're calling open science. And the idea there is to get all of the data and all of the models and the applications that we derive from the data into one ecosystem to get data out to people who need it no matter where they are around the globe. Add into actionable information. People at every level need information to make decisions. We're very familiar with NOAA's mission with weather prediction and severe weather warning, and of course that helps people prepare in the near term. We want to help people prepare for the long-term changes that are coming. And that's important at the federal, state, local, tribal levels. It's also important for the private sector. They have to be able to plan for risks as well. So the idea is get this information out there where people can make use of it to make better science-informed decisions.
And that's what's great. And what's incredible about all this information, Karen, is it's accessible to everybody.
Absolutely. In fact, part of the Open Science Initiative not only is to get information out there, but it's also to get more people working on our data and joining us in asking a broader variety of questions that we can answer with our data. So we're trying to lower any barriers to access through this initiative as well.
And it's so important to get the prognostics into the models, make them better, get the earlier warning signals out for places like NOAA and the National Weather Service. And each Earth satellite that we put up there is a part of that.
Absolutely. We assimilate the data from all of our observing systems and, as you said, capture it in models. And it's the models that give us the predictive capability. The observations tell us what's happening now, but it's the models that help us see into the future. And that's really where we get the maximum benefit from these observations.
And on the space show, we will be, over the next few weeks, looking at some of those exciting new missions coming up and also at some of the missions that are already underway and describing some of their results and findings. So that's coming up in our Planet Earth series here on the Space Show. And we'll have another episode of that next week. Well, we've had Chris Hadfield on the show, so why don't we have another of his songs? And again, this is an Earth-based one, and this is called Prairie Graveyard Waltz. Chris Hadfield from Canada.
Wonder if you, like me, lie awake too. Miles away in separate beds, thinking over all that was said. In words made you bleed, some of them true. Now I cannot sleep, thinking of you. I can remember feeling so fine when your eyes moved to meet mine. A message would pass with no word at all, a smile, a spark, and your thoughts would call to me over the room between we two. Now I cannot sleep, thinking I cannot sleep, I toss and turn. Sometimes I'm cold, and sometimes I burn.
Sometimes I wonder if I have done the right thing at all. Never a letter, never a call. So I lie awake and wonder again where we might meet and when, and how would that go? Could I make you smile? Yeah, maybe, but after a while, what could I say? After all we've been through, but I cannot sleep thinking of you. I cannot sleep thinking of you.
That was former Canadian astronaut. No, he's not a former Canadian. He's a former astronaut who lives and is still a Canadian citizen. With Prairie Graveyard Waltz, one of many, many songs that he has recorded. Well, this has been the Space Show, and we'll be back next Wednesday at 7 o'clock, COVID permitting. And the Space Show is presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. And we're a non-profit, non-political group of space enthusiasts, and we just love sharing with people the excitement of space exploration. Now, we do hold public meetings. Our last one was a week ago. And we have a great time, so please join us. The Space Show also has a website, which is space.southernfm.com.au. That's space.southernfm.com.au. So, please join us. And we'll just go out with this.
This is Planet Earth. You're looking at planet Earth. Ba, 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 ba.